Namaste and in La Ketch, and welcome to this episode of One World and New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and as always, I'm going to extrapolate on the meanings of those two phrases. Namaste comes from the Sanskrit, India, and it's spoken, it's called Brahmi, and it means the divine in me recognizes the divine in you. In La Ketch, comes from the other side of the world, the Mayan civilization, and it simply means I am another you. So think about that as you're greeting people daily and even looking at yourself in the mirror. Try those frames on as how you look at others and see what kind of difference it makes in your life. Don't believe me? Test it yourself. All right. So we've got a great guest this week. His name is Don Schmincke. And I hope I pronounced that right because I didn't ask beforehand. And he is just a really vastly experienced gentleman. He's the explorer and scientist and author who trained 15,000 CEOs to drive higher strategic performance and sales. That's just one of the things. He has degrees from Johns Hopkins University. He's got a master's degree in human behavior and organizational administrative science. And he's also adjunct faculty at Johns Hopkins. I believe there's another degree in there that I missed, and I apologize for that, but I'm sure you'll correct me. What I'm fascinated with, he's been a speaker for the Young Presidents Organization. And what that means is he had to have been the president of a company that made $40 million before his 40th birthday. He's also the author of several books, including The Code of Executives, The Code of the Executive, and High Altitude Leadership, as well as the, continuation of the title of the first book is 47 Ancient Samurai Principles Essential for 21st Century Leadership Success. So perhaps we'll get to talk about that soon. Don, it's a pleasure having you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great. So, you know, we've talked a little bit beforehand kind of where we're going. So what I attempt to do is to draw out personal experiences of how you found the bridge between the inner and outer lives that we live and how that first became evident to you that there was those two. So let's start there. How did that first take place where you had an inkling that there was something more to life than just the outer experience?
I don't know. I think it's, you know, when I was a young kid, my mother said that I was asking questions. I was looking at different things. She ended up introducing me to an organization that actually collected a lot of information around the world, some psychic, some religious, some cultural. And so I ended up being part of that. And it really helped me as a child get access to literature and searching, and the organization is called the Association for Research and Enlightenment, Standard Virginia Beach. So because she took
Edgar Cayce.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I ended up being on the board there many years later.
Oh, you probably know a good friend of mine then. His name, and I'll, Patrick, he's from Phoenix, Walsh.
Oh, you know, I think
Ring a bell?
Yeah, it's been like 15 years or 20 years or so.
I
know the name. I'm trying to picture the face. But anyway, so I did that. And then that was an area. And my whole life, I was really sort of, at that time, struggling with some things. I ended up almost dropping out of high school. And until the police told me that I had to repeat my senior year, and I'm like, there's no freaking way I'm going to stay here for another year. And I said, what do I got to do? And they said, well, you got to do a whole year within the next 90 days or something. And I said, fine, let's do it. And the teachers are really supportive, and I was pretty motivated. I actually did the entire year within, you know, 90 days. And so I did graduate. And then I, you know, I was in rock bands at the time, and I was just wandering, and certainly I was exploring Eastern philosophies, And a lot of this was during, like, you know, the Woodstock era. So it was easy to get around people that were also exploring this new thing.
Sure.
And I was working at my uncle's gas station, and I noticed that a lot of the guys with the fancy cars had an education. So I thought, well, you know what? I don't think I'm going to make money in rock bands. So
some do, but those are rare cases, right? Exactly. I tried it too. I was a drummer in a rock band. I still play today.
Oh, cool. I need to pick the guitar up again. But I haven't. That's good that you're still doing it.
I love it. Golf, which is where I met Pat, and drums are things that I've been doing since I was a teenager.
Oh, neat. Cool. Excellent. Well, anyway, what happened at that point, there was a community college up the street, and I thought, well, why don't I go there? And they really didn't care if I showed up or not, which I thought was interesting. You know, it wasn't like I was going to have the police chasing me. It was like, they got my money. So I didn't need to show up if I wanted to waste the money on it. So I ended up really getting excited and got involved with various things that I just jumped around on, like computers and physics. And
do you find, as you're searching for something, did you find that because of that early introduction to an expanded awareness that your passions spilled out over into multiple areas and that you actually spent some time with each one of them?
I didn't notice it at the time. I was just curious. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was trying to understand, you know, what all this meant. And but at the same time, in the real world, I had to figure out, well, how do I get a good job?
How am I going to survive, right? Or more or less, how am I going to thrive, really? Because that's the optimal.
Yeah. So I must have done something right, because I got a couple of associate degrees, but I got really involved in student activities, and the woman running it was from Boston, her husband from MIT, and then retired physics professor from MIT was also there, and they both said, you should apply to MIT, and I'm like, I don't know.
That's what the one I missed.
You're right, yeah, right. So I'm thinking, you know, what is that? Is that a trade school? I mean,
Right. I actually took the class with Otto Scharmer, his Transforming Business Society and Self. There were 32,000 students worldwide in this series, and it was just phenomenal.
A lot of these mega courses have been inspiring when you see the impact they're having. But I was there long before that. I had left a long time ago.
Sure.
Had the internet and all that happening. So I got in, and I was like, whoa, what do I do now? But, the focuses weren't really in any one thing at a time. It was really multiple. Mm-hmm. So, I was working in electrical engineering, computer science department. So I was studying there, and then I got bored. So I added planetary sciences to that. At the same time, I did my thesis with the Harvard MIT Biomedical Engineering Lab, and then I was designing, helping a small part, just supporting a team designing the nuclear triad missile program. So I was in and out of a lot of different things. What was really good about it is I was able to integrate various themes, various sciences and engineering protocols. So my interest in humans came about around that time. This sounds strange, interested in humans, but
I get it. I totally get it, because that's kind of where we end up, is once we get the smattering of the educational explorations and the curiosities and things like that, it's okay, now where do we make it practical? And that comes back to the human dynamic and understanding humans better so that you can actually get those things to work.
Yeah. And it was a journey I didn't really expect, because that's when I ended up at Hopkins and I did my graduate work there. Mm-hmm. And I got fascinated with how humans organize and how we were evolving. And so I ended up teaching there. Dr. Kathy Trower, before she went to Harvard to get involved with the governance leadership program that they were really doing a great job pioneering. She brought me in, and I, at that time, I was working with a number of CEOs, and I was finding their frustrations with management theory implementation. So she asked me, well, what would I do differently? And I designed something, and she said, I'll teach it. I'm like,
what? What time frame was this in?
Oh, this was probably in like the early 80s, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Way before Senge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Long before that.
Okay.
I began to, so I loved teaching. It was fabulous. But then Oxford University gave me access, permission, copyright permission to study and re-edit one of their manuscripts that was an ancient samurai training program that Dr. Al Sadler had translated about half a century ago. So I took that and I wrote something called The Code of the Executive as just something to use in my classes, because I was teaching in the graduate school at Johns Hopkins at the time. But then it took off into like, I don't know, 15 languages. The next thing I know, I'm being asked to speak, and I'm like, what is going on here? But that ended up catapulting me into a whole nother area, which was training CEOs. So, you know, that's how I ended up training, you know, so many CEOs.
Fascinating. Now, what did you find going back into these ancient philosophies, right? And of course, it was called philosophies up to the 14th century before it became science. What did you find that resonated with you that really the essence of it that you brought forth into being able to express it in the modern day as tools for transcendence of challenges and problems?
It took I really took a team approach, and I was just blessed by being connected with a lot of brilliant people. And so you know, combining anthropology and evolutionary genetics and the new realm of evolutionary psychology that Dr. David Buss pioneered when he was at Harvard. In fact, we've been chatting about maybe doing a book together at some point. It was using their insights that helped me look at, you know, our species and how it evolved. And so it let me come up with models that we could test in companies. And what happened is the sales of these companies went up like two or three times, in some cases 10 times within a few years. And I asked the CEOs, is that important? Because yeah, that's pretty important. So I thought,
And they just have to have the capacity to handle it, right?
Oh, right. So I ended up self-funding all the research. So that led me to every year I would take one or two expeditions into remote regions of the world to observe and learn from these various cultures and their various philosophies or insights in life. And that gave me just a ton of work, because we, you know, by filming and interviewing and just living, you know, in those environments over the next 15 or 20 years, I went through a number of fascinating experiences. But each time I brought stuff back to try to make a difference in organizations and leadership. Some of it worked, some of it didn't. The stuff that worked, we ended up honing more. And so that's why a lot of the workshops I do now to teach executives is a combination of, you know, 20, 30 years of research and expeditions and some brilliant minds that have.
Sure. I had the opportunity to engage one of those brilliant minds as well. I was in the aerospace industry in the 80s as started as a machinist and then became a production control coordinator. So I was in charge of $7 million a month and 800 part numbers for commercial spares. But what I eventually did was I got them to agree that interpersonal skills classes were necessary, and I found a consultant, brought him in, and in that process, we developed a relationship, and he'd mentioned that in the 80s, when American companies were trying to get a foothold globally, the 80% of them failed because they didn't spend any time learning about the culture that they were going into. And right. So they tried to prescribe their culture in place of the existing culture, and people just didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
So how did you find it in your research? How did you get beyond that? Was it just as simple as, hey, you guys need to study the local cultures first? Or were there some golden threads that went throughout that were applicable?
I just went in empty. You know, I whenever
good place
I
to start.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these expeditions, I either was going in because I knew a team that was going into the area, so I hooked up with them, or I just picked a spot on the map and then just flew in. And but I always discovered something remarkable. Normally when I was there, I would hire someone that, like maybe an anthropologist or someone that was embedded in the culture, an academic or some researcher. And so that helped me, you know, get deeper faster.
Sure.
And that, right. Because when I hire these guys, it's like some of the regions that I want to go to are regions that have not been touched by, you know, Western presence. That's getting harder and harder to do today. But I mean, a lot of the places I went to have hotels now. So I'm like, okay, I can't go back there anymore. Right. You know, but I say, look, if I see a tour bus, you're fired.
Well, and those things are true. You know, we have spread our culture, not ubiquitously, but nearly so, with the agendas that we've had to do so, that in some ways are beneficial. But I wonder, you know, in the long term, if they are so, because it seems that because of that industrialization process, that we've actually harmed our environment and those kinds of people more than we've helped.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and there's some areas where they're still struggling with, like one of the things I wanted to study in empires collapse, and I never had it. How do you do that, right? I mean, how many empires collapse?
Right.
So when the
Soviet, how do you live to be 1,000 years or even a few hundred?
Right. Well, at the time, fortunately, the Soviet bloc was collapsing. And so I thought, here we go. So I ended up sneaking into that area. And colorful story. I mean, I'm in Austria trying to find how to get through some communist checkpoint in Czechoslovakia with a bright red capitalist auto, was a Ford Escort.
Right.
And, anyway, long story short, I got in. I was in Prague when it fell. So it was dangerous, obviously. I mean, you didn't know when the tanks were going to come in. I tried to hang around with the journalists because I thought they would get shot last. And I just didn't, you know. And then, you know, they had, by the time I got to East Berlin, they had moved to Checkpoint Charlie. So I'm now lost and illegal in communist territory. But I learned so much, you know. I ended up learning so much from the people. And I had my daughter Rowan. She went back into Prague, and I charged her to record. I said, find somebody, anybody that's over 50 or 60 years old, and ask them what was life like, what was changed. And she had some great recordings.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, is that people were crying. It was emotional. And but I was there. I just wanted to see like how that occurred.
So, did you find that in this, let's say, protection that you had, because obviously nothing happened, were there things going on within you, thoughts, emotions, intellectualizations that got you through that, and or things that you noticed in the outer world that gave you doors to walk through that coincided with what was going on in your internal process?
I think it was more synchronistic. You know, if we take a Jungian term, I think there was patterns would occur unplanned and yet very beneficial. And so
you think that had something to do with your intention? Because partially what I've learned is that wherever you focus your attention, intention, and interaction, magic happens, right? Kind of like what you're...
Well, my intention clearly was to learn, but in that whole dance of learning, I wasn't thinking about anything.
Sure.
Because when I look at the explorations, I might have been thinking about questions to ask, but as the journey unfolded, I didn't really step back and think of it objectively. In fact, looking back on some of these experiences, I was like, wow, what were you thinking? Or
yeah. Well, you were in the moment, right? And I think that's an important piece to really look at is, you know, because most of the time, humans, speaking of, they're in the past or the future creating fears that never happen, right? Which eliminate the possibility for being in the present. Well, what it sounds like from what you're saying is that none of that existed with you, with the exception of a small window in the future, because you were thinking about what you were doing and who you could talk with, the questions you would ask, you're formulating things to prepare, which is a much more present time kind of event. Mm-hmm. You didn't have time to think about the others, which from my perspective really facilitates the synchronistic events.
Yeah.
Because you're in that place. And I'm sure that you've probably realized that, you know, in looking back, like you were saying, taking an observer point, kind of analyzing what you went through and looking at, oh yeah, well, gosh, that was interesting, right?
I know, because, you know, when you're in the domain of learning, you don't want to think, you know, because if you're thinking, it interferes with learning.
Important, very important piece in the learning process, because most of the time, it seems anyway, that we want to answer those questions with the thinking we already have or the knowledge that we think we have, when in reality, we need to ask the questions and just shut up.
Yeah.
That's right. And be in that open state. And that's hard to be, because that's an unknown, and that's a really hard place for most people to go through, just to let go and allow things to evolve in front of you or within you, depending.
Yeah. And that was really it. I mean, I remember being somewhere once, and somebody had these pictures, and I was like, wow, gorgeous pictures. And these are pictures of in the Himalayas and a lost civilization that we were investigating. And
wouldn't it happen to have been the Dropa by chance, would it?
No, it was in it was the Bhutanese territories about 20 years ago when they started opening up their borders. So 40 of us got into the country. A dozen of us were on an expeditionary team, but I was like, well, great pictures. Who took those shots? And they said, you did. I was like, oh, you know, I totally didn't remember. Of course, at the time, you know, people think that, you know, these exotic expeditions are sexy. It's like Indiana Jones.
Grueling.
Yeah. Oh, they're horrible. I mean, I love Indiana Jones. It's like, I'm a wannabe Indiana Jones. But a friend of mine's son-in-law won the award from Harrison Ford for the Indiana Jones Award. He's got some great stories. Oh, but cool. Anyway, but when you're out there, you're right. It's what they don't show you is, yeah, I mean, you're exhausted. You're at altitude at 17,000 feet. You're going, I mean, you're just spent. I mean, you're dehydrated, you're exhausted, you haven't slept more than a few hours a night. And so all this is going on in your body because the environment's changed. And
sheer will is the only thing that's getting you through.
You know, people forget to mention about parasites. So I always have friend relationships, and I bring friends home with me. You know, they just, you know, it's like there's a lot of stuff going on.
Right.
So it's not very comfortable sometimes, but it's, I love doing it and I love learning from it, but I can't say that's a great, you know, it's a great,
wouldn't recommend it for people at home, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Don't do this at home. Yes.
Well, and you know, we're getting there's a show that's out on, I think it's Netflix, called Alone. That chronicles people that are sent into isolated areas and survivalists, right? And they're basically sharing their stories. And you can see just the horrible conditions that they have to navigate in order just to survive, let alone keep their sanity.
Yeah. That's why it's best just to watch it on TV.
Right. Well, you know, all those kinds of things. I think it's good for anyone to have an experience of the unknown that really kind of gives them a shock to the system, where they're able to get out of themselves and their own head and just observe and reflect and ask questions. Because we don't do that. We don't, especially in conversations, like I'm sure you've recognized in your corporate work, that especially in negotiations, you've got two people coming to the table with two different dictionaries that they're speaking and listening from, and it's their own. And they have no idea what's going on with the other one until they do, then progress is made.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's important. I think we don't, it's an area that I've been exploring in my personal life is that, because I've made a series of mistakes where I began to learn that when you're having a relationship, it's nice if you agree, if you both agree on what the relationship is. And we never take the time to
do that. That's kind of important.
It's like, we assume that they're having the same relationship that I'm having, because why wouldn't it? I mean, this is like happening, but on the other side, it's a whole different world. And they're thinking the same thing, but you don't realize that where you're in two different areas and usually in areas of conflict, then it shows up. And so then you're like, wow, how come it didn't have harmony in the world? Because I think a lot of us are just having two different conversations.
Absolutely. And I think that's the core is that when those issues come up, we tend to deflect, deny, divert, do everything that we can to avoid dealing with them. And then when we start speaking from a heart-centered place and being genuine, authentic, raw in some cases, because we've never been able to do this before. So we're talking about stuff that we've never been able to talk about. And we're sharing it with someone that we really care about. So we want them not to have the misunderstanding of your intentions or your want of creating a harmony in the relationship. And that's often a tough thing to get through. But once you start, once those few uncomfortable conversations happen, then it begins to give you the opportunity to have more and go deeper in peeling back the layers of those differences so that you can find some kind of agreement, even if you choose to disagree.
Yeah, right. And that's useful in all kind of levels. In fact, a lot of the work we do in organizations is, like somebody was asking me just a couple of days ago, like, well, how can I get my teams and being disruptive? They're not coming together. They're, you know, what do I do? What does this mean? And it's like, well, they haven't learned how to die properly.
Right.
They're like, what? That's like, and not in any management textbook. There's not any training or development in it. But it's like, that's what we discovered, and especially in the ancient samurai work.
How do you die to self?
Yeah, you know, it's in all the monasteries, right? It's in all the mystic religions. But when it comes to an MBA program, it's like, what? Right. But it actually works there very, very helpfully. So the suicide ritual is, even though the samurai are known for their physical suicide rituals, it was merely the suicide of the ego. Mm-hmm. And so I think that journey of committing suicide 1,000 times a day to our ego allows us to learn and be present to who this other person is.
Sure. And the ego turns into wego as a result, right? Because it creates that bonding agent that wasn't there before because you've gotten yourself out of the way and made yourself available to have that communion.
Yeah, right. Yes. Now you can explore.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process, but you have to set it up so that you can actually, you know, you set the work up and then you do the work. And that can be excruciating for some that haven't had that opportunity to examine self to that depth.
Right. Yeah. It's hard, you know, giving up, letting die what you want to have live is difficult.
Right. Now, do you find that in reflection to what I said earlier about being in the present moment, do you find that in that process that these things that they're dying to are past events and regrets or judgments and or future concerns?
You know, we try to categorize like, well, what would that be? And it ended up about 25 years ago, the model that we ended up with is, it's their beliefs. And everything you said falls under a belief. It's a belief about it.
Right.
And so that seemed to be the best comprehensive categorization is no matter what it is, it's coming from a belief that's driving this behavior.
Sure. So there's belief systems there. How did you then advance that into experience systems that are more reliable?
First, it was easy to come up with, okay, what are the main issues that are dysfunctional? In other words, behaviors that don't work in your life.
Right.
And then have the group come up with, okay, what would it look like if you were a high performance, high leadership, you know, highly effective team? And then there's a whole nother set of issues.
Right. And you got the delta.
Yeah, you got the delta. And it's like, okay, what are the beliefs driving this? What are the beliefs driving that? Now, what we ended up doing, it was a total failure, is typically, you know, consultants are like, well, you're from here, you got to get to there. What's the action plan? And we'll move from here to there. And the failure rates are very high with that model. So I had to figure out, like, what, how do we can't just say I'm changing my belief today and it changed. It's just not going to happen. For it doesn't want to die. And that belief knows exactly how to use you to stay alive.
Right, right.
So it was in the samurai research when I wrote The Code of the Executive that something came out that was so politically incorrect, that went against the grain, that was so, I don't know, it violated what we think to be, you know, our kinder, gentler selves. I thought, this is perfect. This has got to work. And it was a, what they described is that the unborn brave, you know, the coward, could be made brave if they had, and this is, we think, well, more self-esteem.
Right.
Self-esteem movement, which has been one of the most disastrous collapses of an experiment, is just failures of an experiment, this self-esteem movement. And the data is not out on that.
Kind of evolved into the... Oh, what do they call it? The generation of the expectations that they have, the entitlement generation. That's the word I'm thinking
of. Yeah, exactly. And so I'm actually doing a section. I'm running a book on entrepreneurship, and I'm actually have a section in there because it has to do with demystifying or myth busting what we know to be true. And so the thing is, is it really entitlement? But I'm hearing some questions, is it really fear of being responsible? Because I've never had to do that before. And, you know, so there's interesting
factor. Absolutely.
About that. So I'm starting to explore that more. But in the samurai thing, it wasn't this person needs to have more self-esteem to be braver. It was they need to have more shame. We don't teach shame. You know, but what I found, and like, you know, I had connected with a lot of people who done some, you know, out of like some of the top penitentiaries, a lot of convicts, and I was always impressed at the high level of self-esteem they had. Since they didn't have shame. So this samurai technique was that you would put the unborn brave, the coward, and make sure that they were too ashamed to turn and run in front of their colleagues. And if they were too ashamed to turn and
run, pressure there,
they
would
go into battle.
Right.
What they found out is that after a few battles, you couldn't tell the difference between the brave and the unborn brave. And it was shame that allowed bravery to occur. So how do we come back to this? You got to get from you know, the you got to get go from your current state of dysfunction to a new state of functional beliefs. So these beliefs must die. These beliefs need to be born. Guess what's going to have to happen? Pain, and suffering, and death.
Right, because you're in process of making your mind the master rather than the slave, with different thoughts that you're feeding it. And that just is so disruptive and painful, because you're basically destroying your life and what you've believed to date.
Suicide. And so basically what we do is we tell the groups, don't do it. Stay where you are. It's going to take too much to get there. And it's interesting, because when people realize that, the bravery rises up.
You know, I've heard it that courage is fear that said its prayers.
That's a good way of looking at it. It's like, it's just the bravery rises up and people want to take on that challenge. I'm willing to suffer and I'm willing to sacrifice for the greater cause. And that's what we don't teach anymore today. And we do in our leadership training, that suffering, sacrifice are missed elements. that we need to have.
Right. Yeah. We're striving for mech enlightenment now in the drive-through,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. Or at least in Western civilization.
No, it's true. It's true. But if you look at any of the ancient philosophers or mystics, they didn't have like a real happy life. Like, this was great. I just had so much fun achieving epiphany.
No,
it's usually a lot of pain and stuff, as you know, because you've interviewed a lot of people.
Right.
It was never fun. It was, you know, it describes some of monks. It was a burning. It was always not fun words they used.
No, and it was a forced transcendence in order just to be okay with what they were going through,
yeah.
and to bring the mind to a state of the same thing, of just doing what's in front of you to do in that moment and letting mm-hmm. everything else go.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think we don't teach this. And I think if we did, the whole issue of world peace would be a lot easier to achieve, wouldn't it?
We'll get to that topic in just a minute. I want to ask you something. I'm an educator as well. I taught high school for a number of years and some college. What I ended up doing, I taught at multiple high schools, special ed, regular ed, charter schools. I was in full charge of a curriculum at two different schools. And then I wrote a business plan afterward to include all the things I saw was missing in a holistic model. Mm. And one of the first things that I saw that we don't do, that, for instance, the Russians do, is there's an assessment of the student, their aptitude, their attitude, their proclivities. We don't do that. We just put them into a box and say, okay, here's what you're going to do. And that's a disservice, because there's so much. And John Cleet, I was in Las Vegas last week for a Freedom Fest event. And John Cleese was one of the main speakers one night. And his talk was on creativity, and that how he had learned growing up that nobody ever mentioned creativity until he was 22. Right. And then he started looking at, okay, what is creativity? And in the fact that his talk was that he'd written a manuscript or a presentation and lost it. So then the next morning he had to rewrite it from memory. And then he found the old one. And he compared the two, and the second version was far better than the first. What it led him to recognize and test was that, as far as the span of it, was that creative people know how to hit the pause button and mm-hmm. just walk away and then come back. And most of them, you know, essentially learn how they can program their mind before going to sleep, and they take the challenge to bed with them and wake up in the morning with an answer.
Yeah.
Right. And it just flows. And so there's that gives the opportunity for realization that we have all that information inside of us. We just need to allow it to emerge. And we got to figure out a way to do such, which falls into the realms of discipline. Mm. And I think this is exactly what you're talking about, being able to just focus and allow those things to come forth, which they do automatically when you're able to put the engine in neutral.
Yeah. 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 And I think, letting go is such an important piece of the journey, because I look at the mistakes I've made in my life, and I made a lot of mistakes, some big ones that have just cost me almost my life.
I think we all do.
You know, so
well, not all of us, but those that reach this level of understanding and work at this kind of level with others, we've all had our excruciatingly fun experiences.
Right, yeah. Right. And it's one of the things on innovation, you talk about creativity and innovation around this entrepreneurial thing as I'm doing this research. We have been conned into thinking that becoming a great leader, you have to do these things. And the things are usually written by an author who was never there. But if they were there, they would have seen the pain, and they would have seen the mistakes, and they would have seen all those things which created this person to be a leader.
Right.
And that's
the honing of the metal.
Yeah. Yeah. I know Sam Walton's interview I read about, was this journalist was like, how did you do it, Sam? You created the most powerful empire, you know, in retail. And all, and he kept saying, you know, I made a lot of mistakes, I did this wrong, you know. And it's like, no, he keeps drilling, like, what, how did you do it, Sam? I mean, really, what was it? That, what was the magic bullet? What was it? He says, okay, it was from experience. And so the journalist is like, finally, we're getting somewhere. How did you get the experience, Sam? And he responds, I keep telling you, I made a lot of mistakes. And so that's it.
Well, right. And that therein is another point. When we ask the question, we really need to listen intently, because oftentimes we're pushing or pulling energy in order to try to find something that we think we're looking for, instead of actually allowing that topic, that answer, that opportunity to emerge naturally. And like we were talking earlier, in a synchronistic event, we just don't recognize those, let alone pay attention to them. We ward them off as coincidences, you know, they're random stuff when they're really not. They're part of a series of thoughts and actions and attentions and intentions and interactions that then evolve to this presentation, if you will, that just takes time. And sometimes that takes 10 years, could take 20, could take decades, could take a lifetime, depending on the question that you start out with, right?
Yeah. And I think that's, was a Carl Jung, meaningful coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. And they do happen. And is there any, speaking of, is there any wish, desire, prayers that you may have had at some point that years later actually manifested as an opportunity for you that you didn't recognize maybe in the moment, but then, you know, moving on and looking back, you saw the connectedness?
Well, it's interesting. I only recently have been diagnosed with ADHD. And looking back on it, I never knew that I had it, but I could tell why I was doing certain things now. It explained a lot.
Sure.
And some things I was doing was irritating to people, and I didn't know why I was doing it either. But
what do you think we call those things, syndromes or deficits or disorder, whatever? Because that it isn't structured in how we've been used to receiving things, and it could be a part of our own evolution where we're able to just have attention on more things than one simultaneously.
Well, it's in the book too, because in this new entrepreneur book that I'm writing, because I was looking at these entrepreneurs and most of them have ADHD. Mm-hmm. And what we began to realize, and a lot of researchers confirm this, that it may be something necessary to evolve civilization or companies, organizations.
It's a higher functional mind, in my opinion.
Yeah, Dr. John Gartner wrote Hypomania, interesting book. He's here in Baltimore, and I know him personally. And he went through to look at these explorers, these people that have impacted us over time, and did a psychological diagnosis to show that there was a combination of things going on that we would classify as disorders. But then the question is, if people didn't have these disorders, would we have left any of our tribes? Would we have tried to branch out into new realms? Would we have evolved? And so the conclusion seems to be coming to, no, it has to be a person that is willing to take those risks, mm-hmm, naturally, mm-hmm, or and think, not necessarily be more intelligent, but can think 700 times faster. And even though that can be an asset when you're innovating and creating or, you know, shifting a civilization, but it's a disaster when it comes to relationships.
Yeah.
You know,
right. Unless you find another that can vibe with you. Now, do you find that, which, you know, sometimes they come from across the world, as you and I both have experienced, right? And that's part of I think, this. So here's a question I'm going to ask. In your discoveries, do you see a kind of natural evolutionary process that's emerging that allows us to have that higher-minded faculty and more ease of connectedness with information that's not present yet, that becomes available because of our ability to be in such a state.
Yes, and it's a pattern that's been going on for thousands of years, and it's not the answer that I ever thought it would be. But the answer was business, mercantilism, commerce.
Trade.
And trade. Trade, exactly. Because, and this, it hit me in the face when I read that book. You probably read Guns, Germs, and Steel. Guns, Germs, and Steel, this researcher brilliantly connected the dots on race and why did the white race become so much more dominant. And he was asked this by a tribesman somewhere, and he couldn't figure it out because there's really nothing different in our genetics, but it ended up being real estate. It's like whoever was going to be, and in the book, it's very complex, but he puts it like whoever was standing in this space that had domesticable crops, domesticable animals that could create more calories per acre so we could fund scientists, philosophers, teachers, all that, they were probably going to do well. And those that weren't in that space, there were in other spaces, is another area. But the other thing we was talking about was commerce, mercantilism, trade. Because guess where ideas come from? The interchange, the interplace between cultures, and you know, exchanging money for value, but then we're having a relationship. And then it's like, well, tell me more about what you learned or what did you discover?
So it's that's where the improvements come in and the innovation. And what can we do better? And how do we do this? You know, there's also another side. There's apparently a genetic aspect of this. And you'll love this. There's a Russian academician named Valentina Morovna. And her dissertation was on she calls it the genetic mutation in humanity. And she's got 2 degrees, I think, in microbiology and astrophysics. And of course, the academician label in the Russian society is their top scientific title. So she gives this dissertation. It's in Russian, but it has English subtitles. My wife actually found it and thought I would love it. And because she says a lot of the same things that we're talking about, only she's found some scientific evidence from it that she offers. And that through this process, we are becoming a new, not necessarily a new species, but a higher being of effective interaction, because we understand naturally this interconnectedness that we've been, it's the inside, you know, we live half inside and half outside. Most of this, especially with what we're talking about now, the business, the trade, the mercantilism, that's an outer activity. Well, what fuels that? And right. That's the inner activity that most of us are bereft of having, let alone acknowledging and having those kinds of intimate conversations that says, hey, you know, I'm feeling this way about that. This just happened.
Yeah. I lost you.
Global peace movement. And how do we do this? How do we allow this natural emergent quality of people wanting to come together, especially after COVID and the pandemic, because we were taught through the media narrative that we need to be afraid of each other, you know, obsessed on self-hygiene, sequestration, and all that kind of stuff. And that actually got people to turn inward, because that's the natural behavior mod of that kind of activity, right? So now we're having this emergence of these people that are questing for something greater, not only within themselves, but within their communities and how they can better serve and, you know, all the kinds of opportunities that are available, which allows the idea of peace to come forth again. And then, okay, now what do we need to do in order to create the opportunities on an individual, community, city, state, regional, national level? And you know, the elephant in the room is the legal and legislative side of things that have allowed aggression to take place, right? And those are the things that we need to eliminate in order for peace to emerge. The other side of it, that's the live side of live and let live. The let live side is, as long as you're not an aggressor, you're free to live however you so choose, as long, you know, not even as long as you're happy. You're just free to live however you choose. I have no right to tell you how to live or what to do, or that I can make suggestions, right? But it's your choice and I need to accept that. You're the iron-fisted dictator of your body, your mind, your money, your property, your thoughts, your love, whatever that is. And that seems to be, you know, kind of a, it's almost a restatement of the old, you know, do to others what you'd have them do to you kind of thing. So do you see that kind of resurgence of ancient philosophy coming forth and being available for some kind of maybe not short-term, but long-term results in the next 10, 15, maybe generation or so?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look at the upswelling of people in meditation courses, yoga courses. Now we're studying Stoicism. Everything is, because, you know, what about the Stoics? I mean, where'd that come from? Yeah, it's this explosion. But a lot of it is because we have exchange of value. You know, it comes back to mercantilism again. Mm-hmm. For instance, if India had no trade outside of India and there was a wall around it, we wouldn't know what yoga meant.
Right.
Would not be an issue. It was like, I don't know what that, we had no communication. They're inside this place. I don't know who they are. I heard they may be there, but I'm not sure.
So I hear you saying is the diversity is what makes the difference. It's what creates that capacity for unification.
Yeah, getting access to it.
Yeah.
You know, and as an example, I was in a deep Himalayan region and I kicked myself for not buying this set of Buddhist prayer beads. Hmm. It's a heavy Buddhist region. And, you know, we get a chance to interact with villagers and things like that. So I fly back and I'm like, you know, I don't feel like taking a month off to go back on an expedition into this region to get the freaking pair of prayer beads. So I was disappointed. Okay, a month later, it's Christmas. I'm in New York City at this intersection where I have all these booths set up. I forget which, it's Park, and I forget. Anyway, if you're in New York City, you know, on Christmas, it's all these booths set up. And I walk by and there's the freaking prayer beads hanging up in this Tibetan woman's stall. And I said, where the hell did you get those? And she said, well, my son, he's in the border of Bhutan. And so he sent
them. Same village.
Over. I'm like, pfft.
Okay, so that's the example I was talking about earlier, right? You had the regret for not getting them. So some part of you intentionally wanted to have them and you put it out to the universe and you just happened to be walking by this booth that there they were, right? So was that another part of you that was managing that whole scenario that you were unaware of? And imagine, and here's that's the first part of the question. And if you were aware of that process more intimately, could you repeat it more regularly?
That's a good question. I would like to think I was powerful enough to cause Tibetan US mercantile exchange. And that's why her sons sold her the beads. But I think it was a meaningful coincidence. I think she was gonna have those beads whether or not I regretted not buying them in the Himalayas.
Well, sure, and, but look at where, okay. But from your own personal experience, right? Rather than show up anyplace else, you walked in front of that booth with those beads.
Yeah.
Now, and yes, I agree, it could have been a meaningful coincidence, but when we start peeling back the layers and looking at the interactive qualities that we actually have, even quantum physics model that Ed Close and Vernon Nepi presented in 2010, they posited that consciousness, space, and time are tethered across 9 dimensions for the human experience. Doesn't exclude other dimensions, just that we're limited to these 9. Well, how do those 9 interact? And what's on each one of those dimensions? What kind of thoughts do we have? What kind of bodies are there? And when we begin to become aware of those through an experience that, you know, may happen by happenstance or by meaningful coincidence, or through meditation or through sheer quest for the experience of them, which a lot of people found in the 60s and 70s through the psychotropics, those doors opened, right? Mm-hmm. And there's now a lot of medical proof that, yeah, even those doors opening to those psychotropics can facilitate healing in people that have tried all kinds of other methods and weren't able to do so. So these are kinds of things that, you know, from a greater science perspective of the constructs of reality that we're beginning to understand. And Morovina gets into these things, Nepi and Close get into them. The spiral dynamics model kind of puts those also in a 9-level framework of the understanding of the individual and how they ascend to a understanding of oneness and service, let's say, at a top tier level. And, you know, then at the very, you know, survivalist state with at the lowest level. And the solfeggio tones are the same way. There's 9 of those that seem to kind of correlate to that 9-dimensional framework. Well, these are, you know, just discoveries that have happened in the last 12 years. So how do we, you know, Gardner's stuff was around from 82, and we still haven't incorporated the multiple intelligence idea in the educational system.
Yeah.
So these things take time, right?
It does take time. I mean, like Hopkins right down the street, I mean, they just published this past year the, you know, the use of, you know, psilocybin as a way to cure depression. I mean, right. And remarkable. But how long did that take? You know, it takes almost a...
Depends on... Here's where I believe, at least and from my experience, would tend to correlate with it. Those are non-linear, non-local moments, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're set up as linear beings for the most part. That's how we've been taught to think and be and do and act and all that kind of stuff. Well, these kinds of things happen in a non-linear and sometimes non-local environment. So how do we acquiesce to being able to enter those kinds of frameworks? And have you found something that works from that perspective in the work that you're doing?
I think it for all of us on the journey, I find that the reaching the emptiness is a place to begin to allow it to occur. Mm-hmm. But on the outside world, to say, how do we apply this? Then it takes time because then you need proof. You know, they're because people, believe me, there's people that create stuff where it's like, really?
Yep.
You know, I mean, I don't know. So, like, I was at a bar somewhere and somebody was pontificating, what about a triple helix instead of a double helix? And I'm like, well, what about RNA transcription? How does that occur? Right. I couldn't answer the question. I never thought about it. But it was a neat idea.
Or how does
right?
hydrogen relate? You know, you've got the Trinity model that's pretty much in everything from the atom on up. But there's one thing that's missing, and that's hydrogen. You know, hydrogen fuels the sun. It's the most prevalent gas in the universe, and it's our bonding agent for our DNA, speaking of. Mm-hmm. So is it possible that there's a transmission of consciousness through that too?
That's what that gets into.
Yeah.
What happened to the Big Bang? And
yeah.
We off for another couple hours on that area. So it's interesting. The journey, I think, is personal when you get into some of these dimensions. Which is, but if you can replicate it and you can define it and measure it, then it's easier to have everyone say, let's apply this.
Right. Like, now, is that measurement numerical or is it experiential? Because there are the similarities of experience that you can denote as evidence and proof.
Yeah, if it's a measurable experiential effect, absolutely. Like meditation is an example.
Right.
Guess everybody's heart rate went down, blood pressure went down. That's all measurable work. The rest is really an internal journey. And I think we get hung up because if we have that in the internal side, how do I give it to you? There was a doubt, and I struggle with it myself because I struggle like how can we take some of these epiphanies, these mystical insights, and make it more like the new normal, right? And the Taoist phrase was if someone asks about the Tao and the other one answers, neither of them know.
Absolutely. I totally get with that. And speaking of the Tao, yin and yang, the two-dimensional model And I got this idea from watching Contact and how they took that two-dimensional schematic and turned it into a three-dimensional piece that then they were able to create the machines from. So is it possible? And I'm simply looking at, okay, I know that in the firing system, there's lights on and lights off. There's yes, no, there's on, off. And that's how our neurocircuitry works in the pulses that go through it. Is it possible that two-dimensional model of the yin and yang is actually a cross-section from a top-down view of a DNA helix with one side with the light on and one side with the light off?
That's a good question.
Right? Because everything's about spin. And that's how the energy moves through us is what direction is it spinning? Is it, you know, is it exploding or imploding? And how do we catch it in between, right? Which is kind of where we're at. We're the physical part of that integration between the inner and outer realities that we experience.
Well, the new developments, which I'm excited to see now that we're starting to experience the new level of, instead of on-off computing, the quantum computing,
right,
which is now being harnessed and now being developed, and now we're starting to see, you know, horizons on products that could use that, brings in a whole nother different calculation. So there will be a non-binary episode, but when you look at the quantum levels of molecules and you look at brain synapses, what's going on there? Is the synapse really on or off, or is there a transitional energy state? Is there something that's still a probability wave, going back to Schrodinger's cat?
Right.
And
waving, or have you condensed into a point? Right.
Yeah. So it's we don't know yet, right? We just know. All we know is what we're experiencing, and then we die. So I think it's worth exploring, but it's almost like there's the inner journey, like I said, where I can't tell you, or I don't know what it is if I did, because the Tao phrase. And then there's the external, which is, well, wait a minute, this is something that we can have some measurement about. So if we're saying that this can change our brain configuration, great, let's take a photograph and then see if it changed.
Right. You know, I wonder if Lipton has done that kind of thing, because he's a proponent of, we're able to change our DNA by how we think, you know, by the choices that we have. And maybe that's true, maybe it isn't, but it does affect how we live and the experience we have, depending on the perception and the perspective that we have of life. Now, do you, talking about consciousness, have you considered or are you, do you think that there's a possibility that we are, that each of us as human beings are an individuated form of cosmic consciousness that is condensed into a specific unit, so to speak, of, well, potentially having a perfected form, fit, and function in the world, going back to that question about design?
Yeah, there's been enough, I think, quantitative measurement on that interconnectivity, whether it was the remote sensing that Targ and Putoff had released back in 1977, that got squelched, but it was published in the IEEE.
Ingo Swan and Lynn Buchanan and those guys.
It was all about remote sensing. And so that says something. Carl Jung, very explicit on superconsciousness and how it projects down into this reality. We look at some of the brain scans around, like, I love the work John Kabat-Zinn did at University of Massachusetts Medical Center, where, you know, Zen meditation produced the same brain pattern in the scans as medicated people. They couldn't tell the difference between medication and meditation. So it's like, well, what does this mean, right?
And well, maybe that's all, you know, that gives credence to self-medication, right?
Yeah. So the thing is, you know, once we get to the point of measurement, then it gets more interesting.
Yeah.
Because until then, it's a philosophy, which means it could be true or not. But in that sense, it's what's inside, because you're never going to be able to get it out of you into someone else until they experience it. So I'm interested in seeing how the quantum work is being developed now, because we're starting to get in touch with interconnectivity And time, you know, moving backwards and forwards, what we see as time and space is changing, you know, as we get more into that.
But do you think that because of that understanding that we're actually being able to explore more of those interdimensional frameworks and maybe find out how those interact with one another from a frequency resonance perspective? Because it's all based on the frequencies, right? The higher you go, and even Dr. Laszlo has done some work on this, is that really that top frame is a very high pitched, almost the Hindus call it the Shabda. Right? You're familiar with it, which is a collection of all the life form vibrations on the planet that produces one tone that is extremely high pitched, and they call it the sound current. Shabda is their word. But those kinds of things are this, again, ancient philosophies coming out now that science is starting to show were actually true. So the evidence, like you're speaking, we're able to quantify and qualify those kinds of things. Now, the trick is to make it repeatable and prolific.
Yeah. And that's happening. I mean, look at entanglement. You know, I mean, that came out relatively recently. And now it's like, wow, that changes our understanding of nature. It's where when two particles are in a relationship with each other, you can separate them. And what happens to this particle affects this particle.
Right.
And they can be at the other ends of the universe.
Now let's take that to another level of how innovation takes place. And there's usually at least three people on the planet that have the same idea simultaneously. Could that be an aspect of entanglement from one of those other dimensional perspectives? You know,
well, then you'd have to be able to show, I mean, it could be from a number of things. For instance, if you believe in Jungian synchronicity, we're all the same person. So obviously you could have the same thought as I had. From a molecular point of view, you'd have to be able to take entanglement and then be able to see how it affects neural functioning to say, well, if I'm spinning this way, it's going to affect in the brain that way. And that person's going to have an experience that can be measured. I don't think we're there yet.
No, I don't either. But these kinds of questions, I think, are valid. And, you know, from stepping back and being able to observe it from a hypothetical standpoint, that, this looks like it could be possible. Now, how do we unpack it and ask better questions about it?
Yeah. And this is where they're smarter people than me, but some of the questions I have is like, if the Big Bang, this hydrogen thing came out and it splintered and then stars formed and formed higher density molecule, like we have in our bodies, came out of a star at some point.
Right.
Because that's how fusion can take.
And I want to add on something I think is necessary. Our bodies are actually Mother Earth. All the nutrients, all the cells, all the material that we have, we got from our planet in some way, shape, or form. And we don't think about that.
And someday we got to give it back. So
maybe. So,
we're just borrowing.
Yeah, well, maybe. There are some folks who throughout history, and there have been more than one that has been identified that actually took their bodies with them. That's, you know, a discipline that is far beyond anything we're at right now. But there might be, you know, isolated incidents of that where people have stayed free of the outer accoutrements that keep us locked in here. Mm. So in the moving forward, I guess, what might you offer to the individual who's been listening to this? And granted, we have had just an amazing conversation and went all kinds of different directions with very practical and pragmatic information, I might add. And I thank you for that. It's a joy to speak with someone that can talk at that level.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And so what kind of practical advice or activity might you share with our audience that would give them the ability to step into that emptiness that we've been talking about?
Well, I think the path has already been laid out. If you look at the ancient mystics, I mean, you can go into the ancient mystical Christianity or Buddhism, I mean, the whole thing on suffering was about reaching the emptiness. And so I don't know if I can improve on that at all, but I can't say that I actually do a good job of doing it myself, but I do know that in between thought, there's a space, and in that space is where you have the emptiness. And from there, creation, ideas, you know, people, you were describing, people go to sleep and they set themselves up for some solution that occurs. So I think there's a lot that goes on in our consciousness, but I can't really improve on what's been done so far around achieving that emptiness. But there are a lot of people smarter than I that talk about, you know, when they're in the zone and when they're, I mean, there's some great people out there. Some of you probably have interviewed already, but that's what I would recommend. Keep searching, but keep empty, keep learning, and don't be afraid to die when you have to commit suicide to an old belief that's no longer serving you. Like, what in your life has to die for you to get to the next level?
And ultimately, if I'm hearing you correctly, and how, you know, we've been kind of talking around the whole aspect of love, right? Because that's the freedom when you're totally free to express and receive, and so that gives, that's the emptiness that we seek. And you know, it's been said, I don't know if this is quantifiable or not, or how it was quantified, but we got 70,000 thoughts a day, right? And how do we manage that? How do we start paying attention to the activity of our mind in order to start to quiet it and be able to find those moments of quietness and emptiness in between? How do you do that?
To find those moments, it's I suck at it. Quite frankly, I have my brain's going on so quickly.
It's the ADHD, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm maybe a little bit of Adderall or meditation, which is a harder struggle for me to get to. I don't know if I'm the best expert to talk to about that. But I find that when I'm in the zone, for me, and I stop thinking because I'm just in the zone of learning. Then I'm no longer sufficient or significant in the process. And it's in that insignificance that I can discover something, or it discovers me. And then I try to see, is that useful that I could teach?
Mm-hmm. Interesting you make the juxtaposition there, because that's true. Sometimes we discover it, more often than not, it discovers us. We just mm-hmm. become aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh. So cool. My whole philosophy in life is to learn, teach, and die. And that's it.
Yeah, well, and if you didn't have to die, what would that be like?
Right? Well, yeah. Well, for me, I like to do what's the Buddhist term? Die 100 death, 1,000 deaths. I'd like to die 100 times a day.
Yeah.
Part of me is dying, and something new is being born. So.
And yeah, sometimes to die is to live. You know, by dying that 1,000 or 100 or 1,000 times or however many times necessary, actually empowers the living.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do I want to take my body with me? I don't know. I think I'd rather check it in for a new one.
Okay. We'll allow that. All right. Don, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. I've gone way over my normal time, and I thank you for being willing to do that. It's been enjoyable. Time's flown. Evidently we stepped into that dimensional doorway where time disappeared for a while.
Yes, we did. Yeah. No, well, thank you. I appreciate you and your interview. You're doing some great work, so I love being part of it in some small way. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And namaste and in la ketch. And thank you all for staying with us through this episode of One World in a New World. I'm Zen Benefiel, your host, and I will see you next time.